Okay, let's continue with the discussion of definition. In addition to connotative and denotative definition, Clark mentions several other types of definition of terms. One that he mentions is stipulative definition. And in this sense, you cannot argue with the way a person uses a word. If a philosopher writes a book and he says, for example, that I'm going to use the word reason to mean sensation and sense experience, and that's a very common use of the word reason in the history of philosophy, you cannot quibble with that. The only thing that you can insist on is that in the book, the author stick to his definition and not use it in a different way halfway through the book. But authors do that all the time. One of the most common in the 20th century, the novelist Ayn Rand, insists on defining reason as sensation or sense experience. But then in the middle of an argument, you'll find the word being used in a different sense, as perhaps non-revelational knowledge we did not get from God, or in the sense of the laws of logic. Now, there are several different senses for the word reason, and sometimes the author will change the meaning halfway through his book. But if he stipulates a meaning, there's no point in quibbling with that. Now, for you, those of you who have read Alice in Wonderland, know about Humpty Dumpty, and he says that he's going to use words exactly as he intends to use them, no matter what they mean to other people. And he says the only issue is who's going to be master, himself or the words. Well, he's confusing when he says that sort of thing, a stipulative definition with a common definition. And he's just going to confuse people by using words in peculiar senses. You can use the word dog to refer to a domestic cat or a domestic pet that meows, but when you use the word dog in that sense, you're simply going to confuse people. But you can stipulate that's how you're going to use it. People will think you're a bit odd. But if you use the word consistently that way, then of course you can't be accused of equivocation. If, however, you slip at times and start using it as other people do, then you can be accused of equivocation. Clark also says that there are semantic definitions, and he gives the example of the circle. Let me see if I can find which page that's on, where the only difference in the two definitions are the words that are used in it. I don't know if it's in the text or in the workbook, but it's simply a matter of defining circle in two different ways. The circle, the propositions have the same meaning, but sometimes people will argue about definitions of terms when the definitions they have in mind mean and refer to the same thing. So those are what we call semantic differences, just quibbles over words. A more important problem, or a more important type of definition that has cropped up again in the 20th century, is ostensive definition. Ostensive definition. It means that you define something by pointing to it. So you define cat by pointing to a particular type of animal. Or you define dog in the same way. Clark makes the point that ostensive definitions are impossible. And this is a fundamental point. Definitions have to be verbal. Pointing is not a definition. He begins his argument by pointing out that there are many things that you can't point to. You can't define, he doesn't mention this, but you can't define God by pointing to God. You can't define soul or spirit by pointing to soul or spirit. Now, if you don't like, if we have some atheists in the room and you don't like those examples, I doubt that, but you can't define justice by pointing to justice or you can't define beauty by pointing to beauty. Now, Clark uses examples from geometry. You can't define line or point in geometry by pointing to them. What you draw on the blackboard or on the overhead is not a line. A line and a point occupy no space. The chalk or the ink occupy space. Those are things that cannot be pointed to. And then he mentions that Augustine, a name that's come up before in his book, The Teacher, De Magistro, points out, no pun intended, that it's impossible even to use ostensive definitions for visible objects. You have to start with words, and definitions always have to be verbal. They have to involve the use of words. Now, are there any questions about any of this, about definition? Connotative, denotative, stipulative, ostensive, any of these things? Yes. Okay. Let me, in the text, page 26 in the text. Okay. Look at the next to the last paragraph. Sometimes an altercation develops over a purely verbal definition. This is a situation where the two definitions have the same intellectual content. And then he gives two definitions of circle. For example, one man says, X is a geometrical plane figure so constructed that the enclosed area is greater than any other with an equal perimeter. Another says, no, X is a line, every point of which is equidistant from a given point. Both of these expressions refer equally and exclusively to circles. The words are different, but the designated objects are the same. So there you have a semantic difference, but no real difference in what the terms mean and what the terms refer to. Okay, if we have no further question about definitions, and if you come up with any questions, please feel free to raise them in a later class. Let's go on with something more important, and that is the study of propositions. Now, we've already defined a proposition as the meaning of a declarative sentence. And I've distinguished, as I'm sure your English teachers have, between the moods of different English sentences. We have sentences in the declarative mood, in the interrogative mood, in the imperative mood, and in the exclamatory mood, different English sentences. The proposition is the meaning of the declarative sentence. Only the proposition can be true or false. Exclamations, wow, or holy smoke, are neither true nor false. Questions are not true or false. Their answers may be, but questions are not. Commands are neither true or false. Do such and such. Don't do such and such. Those are not true or false. Truth is a characteristic or a property of propositions alone. And I want to emphasize that. Words, single words, all by themselves, apart from any context, are not true or false. Now, in ordinary language, we may have a conversation such as this. Someone will say, what kind of animal is that? And your response is, armadillo. Well, there's a single word. Isn't it true or false? Well, it's true only because your response is an ellipsis. Your full response is, that animal is an armadillo, which is a proposition. It's a declarative sentence. If you simply said armadillo without any prior question, without any context, it would be neither true nor false. It might be an exclamation, something of that sort, but it's not true or false. Single words are not true or false, just as commands, questions, and exclamations are not true or false. Only propositions are. And this is very important. Propositions, what do they consist of? In logic. What are logical propositions? Yes, sir. Okay. They consist of a logical subject That is, something about which something is said, a logical subject, what comes next? Actually, there are three parts of a proposition. A logical proposition. What comes next? No, there's something in between. The copula. The verb that connects the subject and the predicate. And in propositions, logical propositions, it's always the verb to be. The word is, the word are. And then you have the third part of the proposition, which is the logical predicate. Three parts. Subject, copula, predicate. The predicate is what you say about something. The subject is the term about which you're saying something. So if we say, horses are animals, the subject is horses, and the predicate is animals, and the copula, the connecting verb, is are. Horses are animals. We're saying something about horses. Now, there are only four possible forms of propositions. Four possible forms. Every English sentence, every sentence in the English language, that is every declarative sentence, that makes a statement about something, can be reduced to one of four forms. And those forms are all horses are animals, some horses are animals, to take this same example, no horses are animals, or some horses are not animals. There's only those four possibilities. Now, in ordinary English, it may be difficult sometimes to tell which is intended. If we read the sentence, horses are animals, we understand all. All horses are animals. Now, but if you read the sentence that children are smart, does that mean all children are smart? Or some children are smart? In changing ordinary English into logical forms, the categorical forms, all, no, some not, you have to first decide what the English sentence means. And this is the first stumbling block that people fall into. I hope that by the end of the week, you're able, each of you is able, to translate English sentences into logical propositions, putting them into one of the four forms accurately. If you cannot do that with an English sentence, you don't know what the sentence means. If you cannot put it into one of those four forms, all know, some not, then you don't know what the sentence means. Now, that's not impugning your intelligence. The sentence may be embedded in a text in which it's very difficult to tell exactly what the sentence means. Clark in the text gives some examples that are very difficult. Let's look at a couple of these. These four types of, or four forms of propositions. Okay, the first one is at the bottom of page 30. Bottom of page 30, next to the last paragraph, he gives the sentence first, all the track men run well. A sentence in English, but a sentence in logical form is all track men are good runners. You don't use the verb run in logic. You use the word to be. So you have to translate it into all track men are good runners. The only verb he emphasizes is the copula, the verb to be. Now let's look at some of the other examples he gives. Children run to school. That's a good English sentence, using the same word run. He says it becomes all children are runners to school. But does it? Perhaps it means some children are runners to school. It's ambiguous. And you have to figure out exactly what it means. The way to do that in a text, and particularly if you're reading a text like the Bible, is to pay close attention to the context, to see exactly whether a statement is being made about all or some people. He talks here about using hyphens or parentheses to change a series of words into one logical term. There is a relationship between those. For example, in the sentence, tastes differ. Two words. Tastes differ. There's one subject and one predicate in English. In logical form, it would be tastes are different. Again, you have the equivalence of one word and one term. But that's not the case in a sentence such as, dead men tell no tales. Dead men tell no tales. There you have more than one word becoming a logical term. The first logical term is dead men, and then you have to put in the copula, R, and then you put in the logical predicate, non-tale-tellers. Dead men are non-tale-tellers. Dead men tell no tales. Sometimes in English there's one word that can act as a logical term, and sometimes it requires several words to act as the logical term. And when you have several, then you have to combine them by either using hyphens or parentheses to keep it clear in your mind that this is one term. We're not dealing with several different terms in this logical proposition. So it's difficult, it can be difficult, to translate some English sentences into logical form. The reason that logic uses just one verb, the verb to be, is to try to make things simpler than otherwise they might appear to be. But it can be difficult. Look at the sentence at the bottom of page 31 there. None but the brave deserve the fair. None but the brave deserve the fair. And he translates it first into a sort of half a form. He says, all those who deserve the fair, and that should be connected with hyphens or all put in parentheses, are brave. Sometimes it's even more difficult. Look on page 32. The English word, and I'm sure you've seen it on contests or sometimes in other places, all except employees may enter. One sentence, but he makes the point that it's two propositions. The first one is no employees may enter, or no employees are eligible in logical form. And the second one is all non-employees are eligible. So there you have one sentence, but there's actually two things being said, two propositions in that one sentence. And to keep the argument clear in your mind, you can't use a phrase or a sentence such as, no employees may enter, or all except employees may enter. You have to state it as two distinct propositions. The proposition is the simplest unit of thought. And in reducing the sentences to propositions, you are clarifying and simplifying things for the argument. On page 33 there, he raises a more difficult example, something you may not have thought of. The sentences, you always squirm out of an argument. That's the declarative sentence in ordinary English language. You always squirm out of an argument. He makes the point that the grammatical subject, the English grammar, the subject is you. But it's not the logical subject. And he says, clearly you is not squirming out of an argument 24 hours a day. That's not the meaning of the sentence. Not at all. And the categorical form cannot be some you. The word always is the logical subject. In English, it's the adverb. But in categorical form, it becomes the logical subject. And he translates it into logical form here as, every time you get into an argument are times when you squirm out of an argument. And you can combine those words with hyphens or parentheses, however you want to do it. Now, it's very important that all English sentences in your study of logic or in your study of any text, next time you read the Bible, pick out a verse, any verse at random, maybe a verse in a narrative or a verse in one of Paul's arguments in Romans, and try to put it in logical form. Translate the verb that he has, whatever it might be, into the verb to be, and figure out which is the logical subject and which is the logical predicate, and then write it down in categorical form. And if you haven't done it before, it can be very difficult, very challenging at first. Yes, ma'am. Okay, that's in your workbook, I believe. I think you've got that as homework coming up. But let's try one. Does anybody want to take a crack at only freshmen need use the back door?
The question is that I thought that sounded like a command to me, that they should use, not...
No, it's not a command. It's a statement. Only freshmen need use the back door, yes. All freshmen are back door users? Is this a complex... No, that sounds funny, but is this is one English sentence, but are we dealing with one logical proposition here, one categorical form? That's the first thing you ought to figure out. Or is this something like all except employees may enter? Yes.
So you got the term only for saying freshmen can use the back door, and saying anybody who isn't a freshman cannot use the back door.
Well, let's think about that a moment. Is that what it's saying? Is it saying, well, it is confusing, and it's confusing because we've never thought about translating it before. Is it saying that all freshmen, how did you put it again, Jeremy?
It's got only at the front of it, which is kind of like except in the first sentence. So it's saying that freshmen can use the back door. And it's also saying that anybody who is a freshman can't use the back door. It's saying only freshmen. So that anybody who is a freshman can't use it.
Okay, how would you put that into a categorical form using the verb to be?
Well, I'm saying.
Oh, yes. How would you use the verb to be, though, in those two things?
Would it be in two different sentences?
Yeah.
Okay, does some freshmen are backdoor users?
No, that's not what it means. It doesn't mean some freshmen are backdoor users.
I don't know.
What it really means is that freshmen must use the backdoor, all others may use the backdoor.
We're getting closer. Now, how can we translate that into categorical language using the verb to be? No, it doesn't mean that. This exercise may appear simple at first, but it really requires you to think about what the sentence means. And that's a particularly difficult example. He enjoys putting those things in there, I think. Only freshmen need use the back door.
Looking at two sentences,
say
all freshmen are required to use that door, others are not required to use that door.
I think you've got it. And then you would have to put those phrases in parentheses to show that they are not, the whole thing is one term, or use hyphens or something. All freshmen are required to use the back door, was the way I think you put it. It certainly means that, but it means something else, too. All non-freshmen...
The verb are required, though. I mean, that's like a...
No, that becomes part of the predicate.
So you're saying required is part of the predicate?
Yeah. Yeah.
So all non-freshmen are allowed to...
Okay. That would work. Now, have we exhausted the meaning of this simple English sentence? In those two sentences, in those two propositions. Yes?
All non-freshmen are any door users.
That would work. That would work. That's right. That would work. That would work. All non-freshmen are any door users. That would express half of the meaning of the English sentence. This is a little bit more difficult than it may first appear. What is the second one there? I was trying to find it here. The poor always ye have with you. What is the logical subject? Now, I gave an example in the text of a sentence with the word always in it. The sentence doesn't mean that to stick with his example, the poor are with you 24 hours a day. The logical subject, again, is always. All the times that someone is with you are times that the poor are with you. That's the meaning of the phrase, the poor always ye have with you, or the sentence. The poor always ye have with you. All the times someone is with you are times the poor are with you. And again, the subject, the logical subject, is all the time someone is with you. Then the copula, are, and then the logical predicate is times that the poor are with you. And you can hyphenate or put those words in parentheses to keep it clear in your mind that the whole thing is the logical subject, or the logical predicate, the logical term, rather than one word within it. That's important to keep that in mind. There's a third one there. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain who build it. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain who build it. Okay, that would be half of it. That would be acceptable. It's a bit cumbersome, but it would be acceptable. All the times the Lord does not build the house, all of which is hyphenated, or if you're German, you can all run it in together as one word, are the copula, and then you have the long predicate. And again, hyphenated or put it in parentheses. What about the other times? Notice the word except. You've translated, as it were, the last half of the English sentence. They labor in vain who build it. Now you have to translate the except half of the sentence. And how do you do that? How do you translate that into logical form? Go ahead, Jeremy. Very good. That's a little long, but it's fine. All the times the Lord builds the house are times when the house is not built in vain. That's the other half of the meaning of this simple English sentence. And sometimes we overlook the fact that there might be two propositions embedded in a simple sentence like this. Sometimes there are giveaways, and Clark has sort of hinted at that with words like except, or only, or none but. Those don't always mean there are two propositions there, but you should zero in on those things and think about it long and hard when you're translating those sentences into categorical form. I'm sorry?
All the times that the Lord builds the house are the times
when the house is not built in vain. Okay.
Lord, Clark does say that we can put them in correct, though awkward.
Mm-hmm. And the better you get at it, the less awkward the sentences or the forms will become. You'll see ways of shortening them, making them more clear. But the one thing you don't want to do is leave something out. If we were to translate that sentence, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain who build it, as simply meaning, for those houses the Lord doesn't build, it's in vain. That's only half of the meaning. It's that word except there that you have to include in your translation into categorical form. And then you have the full meaning of this short sentence, when you understand that there are actually two propositions embedded in it. And it will become very clear. At first it won't be. At first it'll be difficult and perhaps confusing to you. But with practice, and we don't have much time in a week to practice, but with practice, you will find that it will help you in your reading and your understanding of Scripture to translate a verse or a sentence. You don't have to do a whole chapter. Start out small and translate one or two into categorical form and make sure you have expressed the complete meaning of the sentence in that form. Proverbs is a good book to work with. It really is. Are there any questions about the categorical forms? We've learned that propositions are the simplest unit of thought. Only propositions are true or false. Propositions consist of three things: the subject, the copula, and the predicate. The subject is the thing about which you're saying something. The predicate is what you're saying about it. And the verb to be, is the only verb used as the copula, and it connects the subject and the predicate. We've learned that there are only four different types or forms of possible declarative sentences: all, no, some, and some not. Every declarative sentence in the English language can be translated into one of those forms. In fact, it must be if you're going to understand it properly. You have to know how it's modified, whether it's modified by all, no, some, or some not. Another thing I should mention before we leave is that the word some, S-O-M-E, in logic, may mean one, it may mean a few, or it may mean many. It may not mean no, and it may not mean all, but it may mean any number in between. So when we talk about some things happening, or some horses are animals, we may mean one horse, two horse, two horses, or many horses, or most horses. We can't mean all or no, but it does not mean, as you might think it means from ordinary English, a few rather than many. It may mean many. So it's important to remember that as well, the meaning of some. Are there any questions about this? If you'll go ahead and do your reading for tomorrow then, and the reading and the homework, let me see. You should read chapters 4 and 5 in the logic text. And the handouts, there's a handout called Classical Apologetics, one on the cosmological argument, which is an argument for the existence of God, and one called Marstonian Mysticism. And as far as your homework goes in the workbook, do pages 19 through 26, and tests on pages 107 and 108. Oh, you didn't? Is the Classical Apologetics not there?
No.
Okay. Well, forget that one then. Cross that one off if you've got a list with it on. Any questions then about categorical forms or propositions? Well, if not, thank you, and hope to see you in about an hour.